You are listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis, the college ministry of First Baptist Church in Davis, California. And our mission is to shape college-age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. Normally, that looks like meeting on Tuesday nights, meeting in growth groups, and our weekly rhythm. But this quarter, all of life looks different and new. Very few things feel normal. Our normal rhythms, practices, and ways of life have been interrupted or frustrated. And into this unknown time, we want to follow the leading and shepherding of Jesus, our King. And so on this podcast, we want to have conversations that will form you, that will encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and that would actually be a source of King Jesus guiding us through this time. And before we get to this conversation, I want to tell you something that my mentor, Dan Seitz, said to me at the very beginning of my ministry career. Dan told me that big doors often swing on tiny hinges. And what he meant by that was that answers to big, complex issues, such as what might give us joy and life in this strange season, sometimes depend on something that looks, feels, and appears, well, small or insignificant. And so in this conversation, Stanford Gibson, Miriam Hamilton, and I talk about that which we think has the greatest potential to derail us in this season, but also that which has the greatest potential to give us joy. And that's just our daily rhythms, practices, and habits. All right, so here's the hypothesis. Something as small as how you order your day can actually be a tiny hinge on which the massive door of your joy and your peace can swing. In this conversation, we talk a bit about the value of regularly diving into the scriptures. And if you're looking for an avenue into the scriptures, check out our Father Time channel on the College Life Slack page. And if you're not in Slack yet, go to collegelifedavis.com and use the contact tab to get a hold of us, and we'll get you in there. And that's it. Enjoy this conversation about some very important tiny hinges. All right, everybody, welcome to Your Pod and Your Staff. This is the College Life Podcast. This is week two of our podcast. And thank you for everyone who said such nice things about our first episode. It was a lot of fun to do and a joy to get to hear what you guys thought about it. So thank you for your kind words and thank you for sparing your unkind words. It was a deep grace to us. And I am Peter Nittler. I'm one of the leaders of College Life, and I am joined this morning by Stanford Gibson, who's at his home.
Hello.
And we have Miriam Hamilton, your favorite, who is at her home in...
in Southern California.
Hi, Miriam. It's great to have you on the pod.
It's good to be here.
We wanted to take this second conversation somewhere we really thought was sort of mission critical. And so we started this podcast last week talking about big picture. How are we supposed to be kind of be thinking about the coronavirus? When the three of us were talking about where we wanted this to go, this kind of thing kept coming up as the most important thing that we were sort of hoping for and worried about a little bit for our students. And the problem that some of us kept coming up to was that it just didn't sound very exciting, that it was about as important a thing that we could think of, but it just, the sexy level felt pretty low. But then we asked you guys about what you wanted to hear about. And we were surprised, I was surprised, that actually one of the biggest chunks of questions that you guys had that you wanted to hear us talk about on the podcast had to do with exactly what we thought was mission critical. And that was surrounding sort of spiritual habits, spiritual rhythms, spiritual practices, and staying motivated and staying disciplined during this time. And so some of your questions, I have them right here in front of me. Someone asked, how do we still be disciplined in our faith during this time that everything is closed or online? It's a great question. Another question was, how should we stay motivated when we're in isolation? And, you know, that question could be about your faith. That question could be about school. A very, very, very important question. And like I said, this was the thing that we thought was maybe the most important thing that we could be talking about. And the reason is how we handle our spiritual habits and practices and patterns has the ability to sort of derail this time for us, or has the ability to really give it energy and joy and life. And so this topic of how do we have healthy habits and practices is really, really important in general. But right now it feels all the more important as we are kind of thrown out of any habits that we had. And we're sort of revealed as to what habits we did have. We're sort of exposed for if we have some unhealthy habits. But I think the thing that I have sort of sympathy for the students who have asked this question is that the answer seems pretty simple and it's sort of taunting. And here's what I mean by that. It's like if you're asking the question, how do we stay disciplined in our faith during this time? It feels like the answer is you just do it. You stop doing the bad things and you do more of the good things and you just get more motivated. It seems like the answer to these questions is maddeningly simple and not helpful, because if you know the answer and you haven't done it and you continue to not do it, you lose hope that you ever can. You lose hope that you ever will. And so is there a better way to start this conversation than just the answer being, well, yeah, you just do more good things and do less bad things?
I do think there's good news here. You know, one of the issues is that we think about this in terms of effort, that we're just going to have to try harder. Today went terribly. Today I binged a bunch of Netflix. Tomorrow I'm just going to have to try harder. And we think of it on the level of effort, and we don't think about it on the level of skills. And the idea here is that the people that you think of that seem more disciplined than you, they don't have a larger cache of willpower. Yeah, willpower is a muscle that you can develop over your life, but that doesn't vary dramatically among people. What actually varies is the skills to focus your discipline. And I think a lot of that emerges out of the fact that a lot of us are pretty naive about how humans work. And so I think it starts with the question of how do human minds work? You know, one of the things that we've learned about human minds is that being creative is actually really metabolically expensive. It takes a lot of energy to be creative. And, you know, that's really what school is all about. Like, you need to focus energy to solve, you know, integration by parts or to really get going on a composition paper. And so the way our minds manage this is they try to save the energy to really focus on novel creative problems. The issue is that the way that we try to save that energy is when you encounter a situation that you've encountered before, your mind runs a script, essentially, and it says, hey, I've encountered this problem before. I can do this in a lower energy way by just doing the same thing again. And so that's kind of the way we work. And it turns out that because our minds attack problems that we've seen before by running the same script that we ran the last time we encountered that problem, you know, a lot of our choices aren't conscious. And I think that's the big misunderstanding about how the human person works, is we think that we're making this series of conscious choices throughout the day, but a lot of our day is actually just rerunning the choices we ran yesterday. Now, that could be good news or bad news, because the question is, how do you feel about how yesterday went? You know, if yesterday was great, then today's going to go a lot like it. But if you don't love how yesterday played out, well, you are predisposed to make those same decisions again today, unless you kind of take control of those scripts and start to rewrite some of those scripts in order to focus your creative energy on the things that you actually want us to focus your creative energy on, not when am I going to stop watching Netflix and start writing my paper, but actually focus the creative energy on the things you want to create.
Yeah, so let me see if I am understanding what you're saying. So, you know, if I'm a student, or just if I'm me and I'm wanting my habits and my rhythms to not derail me here, because the issue with this situation is that we are given massive amounts more time than we had before. And, you know, it's all at home. And that's something that I'm struggling with, is that I feel like I've worked pretty hard to make home a place of rest, and now home has to be a place of work and rest, so that those habits are thrown off. And I'm not always feeling particularly well ordered in this season. I'm still trying to figure it out. And so, you know, if I'm me or if I'm a student and I'm wanting to know, gosh, how do I make the best use of this time? Because I have the temptation to be formless. I have the temptation to be undisciplined. And not all that is bad, because maybe we've worked hard to make home a place where you don't have to be constantly productive all the time. But now we're in a position where it's like, actually, we do have to be productive in these places. And so we're going to have to maybe learn new habits, or this is the time where we're going to have to start taking this stuff seriously. Because if we don't, it could sort of consume us. So all that to say, so what you're saying is a potential way to answer that question of how do I make good use of this time and how do I stay motivated or, you know, be disciplined. If I'm used to hearing an answer of, well, just do these few things, you're actually saying, actually, let's ask a question before that. And the question before that is, how do human beings and how do human minds work? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And the answer is counterintuitive. You know, I think that a lot of people, whether they're Christians or not, fall into this, what Christians believe is an ancient heresy called Gnosticism. And Gnosticism basically believes that kind of the physical world is bad and the world of mind and spirit are what's good and what's real. And so what we do with our bodies really fundamentally doesn't matter. It's what we do with our minds and spirits that matter. So we can kind of lay on our bed and do calculus, and those two things won't actually interfere with each other, right? But it turns out that the physicality of routine, how we order our time, and space, what the environment of our work and play are, interact a lot with who we are holistically. And so if you want to create habits that make space for creativity, thinking about how that plays out temporally and spatially, how your routine and how your environment funnel you towards these moments of creativity. That's, you know, all the people I know who are incredibly creative and incredibly productive have pretty rigorous routines and pretty carefully designed spaces to make that happen.
That's interesting. I was thinking about on my drive up to my parents' house, there's this big hill you have to go up on the Pepperdine campus, and there's two ways you can go. You can go either straight or you can go left, and they take almost exactly the same amount of time. And I was driving up with my brother, and I went straight, which is the direction he usually does not go, and he asked me, sort of with this like sass in his voice, he said, why did you choose to go this way? And I realized that over the course of the 12 years that my parents have lived in this house, I have never made a decision about which direction I would go. Like one decision where I decided like every time I drive, I'm going to go straight or I'm going to go left. And so I told him, I was like, I have no idea why I went this way, but I'm realizing now that every time I drive up this hill, I have to make this decision again. And how much time have I spent over the course of the last 12 years making that one decision? And what would have been different in my life if I had made the decision already and had a routine and not needed to spend the cognitive energy processing that every time I drove up the hill? Obviously, it's a little bit of a ridiculous example because my life probably would not be very different at all. But you're making me think about all of the small moments in my day where I'm making decisions and what sort of cognitive space would a routine give me to sort of explore other things or to put my energy towards things that might be a little bit more important.
And I like to call that the creativity paradox. The idea that a lot of times we think of creatives as having these very disordered lives, and it's the disorder of their lives that kind of create the mess out of which something truly creative comes out of. But I think actually most creatives I know, I spend a lot of time like listening to interviews with creatives because I'm really interested in how creation works. Mm-hmm. And I think most of them have very ordered lives. If they make it to the point where we've noticed them, it's because, first of all, they put in 10 years of hard work before anyone notice them, but also they focus their creative energy not on the act of getting to the table to create. That happens in the process of routine. All of their creative energy goes into the act of creation. I had an experience this morning where, you know, I got up to run like I do. I actually thought about breaking my routine. I said, I think maybe I'll run a little bit shorter just to make sure that I'm not late for the podcast with my friends.
Just run faster.
Right. I got halfway through my run and realized I hadn't made the decision. Like, I just did what I always do. I was in the script. I was in the routine. It's just something that I do now. And I think that the more we can program, you know, leverage the automaticness of some of these things, the more we can actually focus on the things we want to do, which is generally like making things, you know. And for some of us, the things we get to make, like, you know, solutions to physics problems, maybe aren't as exciting as they could be. But this is training for when you will get to make things in your vocation.
Right. And what I really want to be doing with my day is not figuring out what my day is going to look like. I'd like that part to just be done so I can focus on the things that I know are actually more important.
Okay, so if I am, again, if I'm sort of tracking, I might be a little dense, but let me see if I can like draw a straight line of what I'm hearing you guys saying, is that if we are spending so much of our time outside of a automatic set of practices that we have habituated through intentional choice, and if we are spending a lot of our time trying to decide what we're going to do, then we're using our mental energy for deciding on those small things. And so we're not going to have much left for when we sit down trying to do our homework. We're not going to have much mental energy left to actually do that well and to thrive in that. Is that sort of what we're saying? It's sort of like we have a set amount of resources, and if we're using our resources for these small tasks that could just get habituated, we are sort of robbing ourselves of that more useful discipline time.
And this is why I think it's important. When I was a student, I overheard something a professor said. The professor said, you know, undergraduate is not for learning things. If you want to learn things, go to graduate school.
Oh, man.
And I just thought that was like the most depressing thing I had ever heard. But then, like, after school, I realized I don't use any of the facts I learned in undergrad. And I had a pretty practical major. I was a geophysics major with a math minor, right? Like, I don't use any of those facts.
Yeah.
Undergraduate is about skills. It's about learning how to write a sentence in the active voice. It's about learning to speak publicly. It's about learning how to do a stacked histogram in MATLAB. But apart from those kind of micro skills, undergraduate is about the macro skill of how to take a pretty unformed chunk of time and turn it into something creative. Mm. Because that's what you're going to do the rest of your life, you know, and that's not limited to, you know, white collar jobs. Like, farmers do that too. That is the creative mandate. That is what vocation is. And the issue is that you're now taking a honors level graduate class in that particular skill.
Yeah.
Because the time you've been given is so unformed. Some of you don't exactly have the prereqs for a graduate level honors class in that skill, but it's the skill you've been given to form right now.
I think I've seen this maybe even a little bit more in the negative sense of being worried that the formlessness is going to eat people up. And what I just heard you say, which I'm going to change the way I think, hopefully right now, is that no, this is your chance to maybe get in the class that you're maybe not yet even qualified for. And in taking that class, you are going to get these skills in a way that you were never able to get them before.
This is an opportunity. You could look at this as a tragedy of your education, or you could look at it as an opportunity to advance the most important skill, which is learning how to use time to create.
Yeah. So when you say create, I'm thinking of people drawing pictures, and I'm thinking of people writing songs. And your verb of create includes those things, and also calculus, and also physics, and also all these things.
Any definition of create that doesn't have enough semantic range to include engineering or farm work is not a sufficient definition of create. Create is to make something by applying personal energy to a novel problem.
Yeah.
And it's actually like one of the most fun things about being a human. It might be tied with romantic relationships, but we are most alive and most ourselves when we are applying personal energy to solve a novel problem. But we need to get ourselves in the space to do that.
You know, when you guys are talking about this, it's making me think, you know, if you've been in college life for the last couple of years and listened, then you might have heard me talk about this book, You Are What You Love, or the author, James Smith. And if you were at the beginning of the year talks, we talked about worship. This was the main book and the main influence that we drew upon. But I know in this book, and just in this way of thinking, what he is basically saying is that there are liturgies, or I'll say practices, habits that we have formed that are on autopilot, and they are sort of determining the way that we live our life, and they're determining the way that we go. And his argument is that it determines the way that we worship, but we won't get there yet. What he's saying that I have always found so compelling is that so much of our life is on this unconscious loop that we have just habituated in ourselves, that everyone has all these types of things. It's not just those people who've chosen to have these things. So we all have things that we have habituated and that are unconscious, and that the process of doing that is also unconscious, that most of us are not choosing what we've habituated. And I find that so compelling. And so this seems like it is a season in what you're saying, Stanford. Hey, if you have this vision of yourself as, you know, maybe more disciplined, or just have a vision of yourself as a particular kind of student or friend or family member or follower of Jesus that you're not quite feeling right now, then what might be happening is not that you have a motivation problem, but that the particular things that you have habituated, the particular things that are unconscious that you're just doing every day, are actually not bringing you toward that vision of yourself. They're bringing you to a different kind of vision of yourself. So this actually would be a time, because it's so necessary to have some order in your life, because again, the formlessness, the voidness could eat you alive. You actually have a chance to interrogate what might be habituated right now in yourself, and choose to habituate that which will lead you to the vision of yourself that you're longing for. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I do think that this is a really unique time because, you know, the human mind is processing like millions of bits of information every second, which is wild to think about, because right now I feel like I'm thinking about one thing, which is this conversation. But really, there's so much more that I'm processing. And for the majority of our lives, we're not paying attention to those things. And we have a really unique opportunity in this season of quarantine where we actually get to spend some time examining those things that are more unconscious or subconscious, and to consider if those are the habits and the practices that we want to be subconscious. And I have to admit that there's a lot of this time that, you know, it's been uncomfortable for me because I'm having some of those practices and habits revealed in my life, and I don't always like it. But there's this excitement about, okay, I don't know how long I'm going to be working from my childhood bedroom, spending all day trying to stay motivated with my brother. But while I have this time, it's pretty exciting to think about, you know, the potential in sort of retraining some of those subconscious habits and to put me on a path that I find more deeply aligns with the person I want to be, with the trajectory that I want to be on. And so instead of despairing in sort of the disappointment of all of this or getting really bogged down by how uncomfortable this is, I think that a good place for us to start is with some excitement and optimism and a recognition that this is a really unique opportunity that most people don't ever get to have, and that we get to have this opportunity together as a community.
You know, I spend a lot of my days on Zoom calls with engineers and scientists. And one of the things that I'd like to really encourage students about is that this is not a like young person problem. What I'm finding is there are a lot of people who have been scientists and engineers for 20 or 30 years who are finding that they have habits and practices that are non-transferable to a formless world. And in some ways, it's a neat opportunity for a student to have the opportunity to take control of some of these habits and practices. Or like, I like what Peter said, just choose them explicitly rather than having them chosen for you at this stage in your life, because then you can leverage that for a whole career, like decades of personal creation.
Okay, so this conversation is really exciting to me, and I actually really appreciate the positive spin that you guys have put on it. And you know, often in conversations, I find myself always kind of longing, like, okay, can we just get a little more specific? You know, like, it's always pretty easy to talk in these general ideas. And once you've sort of labeled, okay, we're going to talk about habits, rhythms, practices, then we just use those words interchangeably. And, you know, I'm not always sure exactly what we're talking about. And so can we just hear a little bit about what this maybe has looked like in your guys' lives, how you've inculcated certain things, or what sorts of habits and rhythms you've made automatic and how that's helped you, or just a little bit of your own experience?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you kind of where I've gotten in the last 20 years, and it has taken that. And I guess one of the reasons I'm excited about talking about this is, like, it would be awesome if students didn't have to take that long.
Yeah.
I find my days at work incredibly joyful and life-giving.
Yeah.
I love work. I can't wait to get to work. But I think it's partially because of the way the day is laid out. My days are creative because they're routine. And so every day my alarm clock goes off at the same time, and I roll out of bed kind of automatically, not wondering if I'm going to run, just putting my shoes on and going for my run. And then I have some coffee and I do my quiet time. And that's about when I start having conscious thoughts. You know, up until that point, everything's on automatic. And I do my biblical practices, which I've talked about at College Life. You know, I'm writing this journal for my daughter on the scriptures. And then at 8 o'clock, I start work, but I don't open my work email. I don't open my personal email up to that point, because I know that the period from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock is my most creative part of the day. And I don't want to waste it on email, and I don't want to waste it on trivial tasks. I want to write. Like, I was shocked that as a scientist and engineer, that I was going to have to spend a huge portion of my life writing.
Yeah.
And I find it really difficult, but also really creative. And so I invest that time there. I open my email at 10 o'clock and start doing that stuff. And then when I start getting fatigued towards the end of the day, around 3 o'clock, that's really when, you know, YouTube temptations kick in to most professional workers. I have low cognitive energy tasks like coding, which is just fun, and so it's like solving Sudoku for the last 2 hours of the day, or editing YouTube videos, which is mindless but needs to be done. I have low energy stuff that's slotted in there, and then I have an evening routine that makes sure that my kids and family get the energy and focus that they need as well.
Stanford, I think that you and I might have some different definitions of what fun is.
Yeah.
You know, when I talk to students about what majors they should consider, computer science is always the first thing I offer, because computer science is basically getting paid to solve puzzles all day.
Okay, I have a question to ask, and it could be a doozy of a question. What do you think is the thing that is motivating all this? Because I was at first going to ask, why do you get up at the time you get up, which you don't have to name if it's going to be depressing for the rest of us. But, you know, you kind of think, okay, well, like that decision is probably determined by how much you want to get done in the day. Or you could even think, okay, I'm going to get up at 5, whatever it is, get up at a certain time because I want to make sure that when I get home, I'm not taking anything home with me. So I'm going to front load my day. And so actually my time at home is going to be the thing that I'm aiming my life towards, being dad and husband at home. And I'm going to work in a way that allows me to do that. Or I'm ordering my day to be the most efficient, productive worker I can be. I guess I'm curious, do you have a sense of what is the motivating factor for you? Or is it all sort of cumulative?
I think the motivating factor is generally joy. Like, I want to do the things that are going to bring me the most joy. It's a little bit hedonistic, honestly. I think the things that the most joy are acts of creation. But I did stumble on a principle in graduate school. I have a friend, her name's Tiffany, and she was a PhD student in English Lit. It's a top 5 program at Wisconsin. And she developed a principle for navigating all of the claims on her time. And the principle was, wherever you are, make sure you're fully there. And so she didn't worry about school when she was doing ministry, and she didn't worry about ministry when she was doing school. And so I think that's definitely a motivating factor, is I want to be present as a father, and I want to be present as a creative, and I want to be present in ministry, and I want to be present with God. And the way to actually be in the moment isn't to just let the moment fall upon me, because those moments will never just fall on you. The way to be present in a moment is to put boundaries on the moment so that you can be present in it. And so what boundaries do is they also say, this is my moment to spend time with my children. And you know what? Work's not allowed in here. Because, hey, work got its time, and I gave that everything it was. And I just think that in that way, I can experience the joy of being a child of God. I can experience the joy of, like, kind of quasi being an athlete, or at least not dying of heart disease early, and enjoy the moment of being a father in their own right, uncluttered with the other things that might try to press in on them.
Something that I think is also important to consider here, though, and I have a hard time with, is that when you're in college, your schedule is just uniquely spontaneous. And unlike any other time in your life, you're not going to work or going to school and spending all day there and then going home. Your day is usually a whole bunch of back and forth between home and work and school and friends. And so how do you put boundaries on the time that you're spending in class, or the time that you're spending with your friends or studying or working, when you don't have so much of that already instituted into your day?
One thing that I sort of long for in the college schedule is sort of what Stanford is even just talking about, of like, if I'm in a class for 2 hours and then I'm in another class for 2 hours, it's like, how great would it be to just be in that class for those 2 hours, be fully engaged in it. And then once you leave, you're fully engaged in lunch with your friends, and then you go to the next class and you're fully engaged in that class. Or, you know, if you have a bigger break, you're fully engaged in that studying time. Or maybe you think, I'm going to read the scriptures at 11 o'clock after my, I was going to say MATLAB class. Those don't exist, right?
No,
MATLAB's not a thing that has a...
You can take a class in MATLAB, and you should.
Okay, cool. I probably won't, but... So I wonder if the sort of uniqueness of the college schedule, which, are you talking that there's these big gaps?
Yeah, there's gaps in your day, and also your attention is constantly being drawn to multiple different things at once. So much time is spent also with other people while you're doing these things. And I know I struggled, and still do, but in a lesser extent now because I'm not in college anymore. But I struggled with when I'm in class, I'm thinking about the homework I have to do for another class.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about where I'm going to go study and who's going to be there. And, oh boy, should I go there because I really want to hang out with them, but I also need to get this done. Can I just manage to get both done at the same time, hanging out and studying? And most of the time I was able to convince myself that, yes, in fact, I could study or do my homework just as effectively with my friends around as if I were home alone or in the library.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe what we're talking about too is what Stanford just laid out, you know, when I think about what is my hope for myself, like that feels pretty close to what my hope for myself is. And just sort of that disciplined, I'm going to get up at this time, I'm going to exercise, I'm going to spend time with God. It's like same thing every time. I'm just going to bank that, and then I'm going to work really hard, and then I'm going to be at home in the way that I want to be at home. I think sometimes hearing it all, like you said, like 20 years of refining and adding things, and this didn't all happen overnight for you. You didn't put all these practices together at one time. I wonder if even Miriam, a little bit of what your question's getting at too is, well, that seems really, really hard to get there. Basically impossible. I mean, if we were to stop the podcast right now and say, okay, you want to be more motivated, you want to be more disciplined, Stanford just gave you the answer. So go ahead and get started and wake up at, you know, 3 a.m. and you're on your way. Then that would be pretty crushing, I think. So I wonder if it would be good to spend some time talking about, okay, what's the first step? Like, what's the first habit to put in to start building this collection of habits, or even just get us started towards some habituation of healthy things? What do you guys think?
It's encouraging for me to look back on my short life so far and see the practices that seemed so impossible to me when I was a kid. And one of those, embarrassingly enough for me, was brushing my teeth.
Wait, morning or night, or both? It. Morning or night or both?
Both.
Yeah. You know what? Wait, before you go, you know what I used to do? I used to not want to brush my teeth in the morning. And so what I would do is I would go into the bathroom, and I would turn on the faucet, and I would wait the requisite amount of time that one would that one would brush their teeth.
Right.
And then I realized, I guess I'm in here the exact amount of time. I could just be brushing my teeth. Anyway, sorry. Go on.
Yeah, I just was terribly undisciplined in that arena of my life for a long time. And I remember that my sister and I shared a room, and if I went to bed before her, or if she didn't witness me brushing my teeth, she knew me so well, and I think she just enjoyed lording this over me. She would come into my room and while I was in bed already, and she would just go, "Miriam, did you brush your teeth?" And I'd sit there and just think, boy, I want to lie to her so badly. And then I'd stumble out of bed and go to the bathroom and brush my teeth. And now that seems, you know, ridiculous. Like, I brush my teeth, and that's just part of my habit. But it did take a long time to develop that. And it is a little embarrassing how long it took, but I got there. And, you know, similar things have been said about things that are, I would say, a little bit more important to me, like reading my Bible. I mean, that took so long to develop the habit for instituting a spiritual practice that I find foundational to my faith. But I wouldn't have been able to start there. I wouldn't have been able to start necessarily with, okay, now I'm going to be somebody who reads my Bible every day. There's a whole lifetime of practices that don't even feel necessarily spiritual that I learned to develop. And part of learning to develop the harder, a little bit more complex and more spiritual disciplines is learning how to develop routine, period. And I think a good place to start, just to tie back to brushing your teeth, is actually with your morning routine, mm-hmm. and your bedtime routine.
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree. I feel like before I was married, my nighttime routine was just so horribly disordered, and it would bum me out every single day. Every day I would have this new vision of, like, I'm going to get to bed at a time when I'm not horribly tired and I haven't just been looking at a screen for the last couple hours. I would go into my room, and then for like the next hour, 2 hours, I would just be on my computer or be on my phone doing, I don't even remember, watching things. It wasn't just that I had lost sleep, but I was so disappointed in myself because I knew that, okay, the next day I'm going to be tired. And I knew that this was a waste of time. And I knew, you know, it would just keep happening and happening and happening and happening. And then I got married and there's another person there now. And so I'm not just going to sit there watching something else. And then we go to bed together at the same time. And we have our own kind of bedtime routine. We floss out in the other room and then we come and brush and we go to bed. And that habit is now totally broken. I don't have any desire to ever go back to the way it was before. And, you know, so obviously, that's why you need to get married, is so that you can have
you can floss in the living room.
Noted.
Yeah, floss in the living room. But all that to say is just that for me, it took getting married to break the habit. And once I did, it produced a ton more joy in me. And I guess I'm just sold on the fact that these types of things really matter. And I do know that there's certain spiritual communities that really take seriously the nighttime. And they think that the next day starts with the way you go to bed. And, you know, there are monastic communities that would pray the Compline prayer. And the idea was, if you are getting sort of holy sleep, then that is setting up the next day. And I did not think that way. The previous night and the next day felt totally independent. And so I could abuse the nighttime and I wake up and it'd be a brand new day. and I would be a brand new person. So I'm totally sold on this idea. I think this is a good first place to start. Do you have any thoughts on this? Waking and sleeping as first step habits. What do you think, Stanford?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I even have found a lot of value in just doing them at the same time. I think that biorhythms matter. I realize that's kind of a tall call for a college student, but I do think that it'll add order to your life. And I've just come to believe that people become what they do in the first 2 hours of their day. The first 2 hours of your day sets the trajectory for the rest of your day. And here's why, is that habits have cues. They don't just happen out of midair, right? There has to be something that initiates that script that your brain is running. And so I don't have a habit of doing my devotional time. I have a habit of doing my devotional time after I run. And so what you get is this cascade of habits, that habits actually form additional habits. And so if you really focus on how am I going to spend that first 1 to 2 hours of your day, it can often cascade into other productive work and other productive time, times of joy, times of creation. Whereas if you leave that first couple of hours of your day unformed, the chances that the rest of your day will be unformed and that you'll even feel guilt about procrastination and that'll have negative feedbacks, I think is really, really powerful. So I would start with, what does the first hour of your day look like? And in order for the first hour of your day to be energy-filled and life-giving, that starts with the last hour of the previous day.
That's interesting. And so you're saying, again, to get pretty specific, if someone were to say, okay, my new habit is that I'm going to be productive in the morning, that's not what we're talking about. The habit is I'm going to, this is yours, but you're saying I'm going to go on a run and then I'm going to do my quiet time and then I'm going to do some creative work.
Right. But an alternate would be like, I'm going to get up. I'm going to immediately take a shower. I'm going to put some pants on. I'm going to make some coffee. I'm going to have a yogurt. I'm going to sit down at the table and I'm already going to have the most difficult task that I need to solve that day open on the table the night before when I sit down. And all of those things become automatic and usher you into the moment of creativity.
Yeah. When I was working at Sunshine, I had some older staff. She was teaching me about how she sort of ordered her day. And she said it always began with the night before when she would make sure the boat was clean. And she would set out the pot of water that she wanted to boil for coffee in the morning. She'd set up all of the coffee and she would catalog in her mind what time she needed to wake up and what the first few things she needed to do were. And so that provided her with the space to, when she woke up, not have to think about those things and to make sure that all of her needs were already going to be met. And so in especially an environment where there's a lot of uncertainty and things change very quickly, she already had a routine laid out so that she had more space to deal with sort of all of the uncertainties that come in the day. And in the last few years, I've integrated that practice more into my own normal, less chaotic life. And I see the way that developing a routine of going to bed and considering, okay, what is it that I need to consider the first thing in the morning? Like, what are the first most pressing things that need to get done? Okay, I'm going to do that after I do my morning routine. And in the morning, I'm going to go through just the normal routine that I have. And it allows me to make sure that my physical needs are being met, that I'm actually taking care of my most basic needs, like hygiene and hunger and maybe caffeine and reading my Bible. And when those most basic needs are met, I'm more ready to face the rest of the day. And also it gives me space to just be more aware. You know, I'm home with my parents right now, and my dad was commenting the other day on the generational differences he was seeing in the way that I make my morning coffee and the way that he makes his morning coffee, which is the Keurig on his end and AeroPress on mine. And it's not about, for me, making a good cup of coffee, although I do enjoy a good cup of coffee. What it's about, I told him, is that I have just so learned to love the process of making a cup of coffee, because there's something about it that just gets me to be more present in one thing that I'm doing, instead of waking up and feeling scattered about everything that needs to get done, not really being able to order my day and feeling very disconnected from what's coming. And there's something about the act of making a cup of coffee, of spending the time like heating the water and putting the beans in and all of that, that kind of grounds me and makes me aware of where I'm at. Because every day when I'm starting the day, I'm in a different emotional space and I'm in a different mental space. And I need to take some time to catalog what those spaces are before moving on to the rest of my day.
So Miriam, like, what does that look like? What are the types of thoughts that you think as you're making your coffee? Are they, here's the way I'm going to solve this problem? Or is the merit just becoming aware of your emotional state?
Yeah, I think that really is the merit of it. My thoughts are far from brilliant in those times. But maybe this is speaking as someone who's maybe more emotional than the average person, but I can notice for some reason or another, I will wake up and feel sad some days, or I'll wake up and I'll feel excited, or I'll wake up and I'll just feel like disconnected or frustrated. And if I don't take time to be mindful of that, then it's going to bother me for the rest of the day. It's going to be something that's just playing in the back of my mind, trying to figure out, why am I feeling this way? Or what am I even feeling? But if I can simply turn towards that and say, okay, I'm recognizing for whatever reason right now, there's some anxiety in me, then I can sort of just put that aside and continue on with my day, knowing that I'm feeling that way. But if I don't take the time, or I don't allow myself in my routine the space to turn towards those emotions or that mental space, then it affects the rest of my day in a way that it wouldn't if I could just simply recognize it and set it aside and maybe consider, okay, what are some further needs that I need to take to address this before moving on to the rest of my day?
So, okay, then I'm hearing you say two things, which I think are helpful for this conversation, because you were talking about how, you know, taking care of your needs first and foremost in the day, and you're talking about like hygiene and food, and then you said caffeine, and part of me was like, whoa, that's not a need. That's something that you want, and that's something that you like, which seems good. It seems like, okay, well, then you can actually build some things that you like that are going to be exciting to get you out of bed into these habits. And you're also saying that what we're not saying is you need to maximize every hour for productivity.
That's right.
The goal is not that you would just be the most productive worker that you can be, but the goal is that you would thrive. So you're saying that for you to thrive, you need some almost empty time at the start of the day, that you're not necessarily doing something with your mind other than making coffee, so that your mind can assess how you are. And that is necessary for you to thrive the rest of the day. And if you were to ignore that, if you were to say, actually, I need to do something more quote unquote productive, the people listening can't see my quotes, but if you were to need to do something quote unquote productive, then you might blow past that need of yours or that desire of yours and just be a shell of yourself. And maybe that's just putting it too strongly, but you would be missing a level of thriving that you do have right now, because it's in a rhythm. It's a habituated process that is aimed towards how you think you could be thriving.
That's right. And that need is going to look different for different people. Not everybody needs the same amount of space in the morning to consider their emotional state. But I've learned that if I were to have woken up late for class in college and had to sort of quickly get dressed and go to work, which happened more times than I care to admit, then I can sense, and I am those experiences have made me very aware of the ways that not having a routine sets me up to just be frazzled for my day, as I'm considering all the things that didn't get done in the morning, both in terms of, okay, I didn't get to take a shower, or I didn't get to spend time considering what I actually needed to wear this morning for the weather or whatever, and I didn't get to eat, and I didn't get coffee, which you kind of caught me there. Coffee's not a need, but I've sort of tricked myself into thinking that it is. But
no, I think it's important that it's not a need and that it's part of your
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. But there's a different state that I am in going throughout the rest of my day. And so much of it is spent thinking about the things that I still need to get done, or that the needs that weren't met. Whereas when I can follow my routine, the needs are met and I'm more able to be focused and present on the rest of my day. And it allows me more space to be Stanford, like you were talking about, to be creative and to spend time thinking about and problem solving the things that really, really would be a better use of my time.
I think that's brilliant. And one of the things that I find really, really interesting about that practice, Miriam, is that in some ways it could seem like an indulgence that you would spend this time just kind of assessing your emotional state. But in some ways, by tying it to this very physical, very pleasurable, but discrete practice, you're actually constraining your emotional assessment, which could go on for the rest of the day. But you've said, this is my time to assess emotionally. And it happens over the course of making a coffee. And I just think that's remarkably healthy, because once you have that coffee in your hand, that's a cue for the next habit. I just think that's brilliant. The other thing I will say is that it's in the habit literature that building pleasurable experiences into need-to sorts of habits is something that it's just smart. And so I am unrepentant about my non-grown-up coffee. Those of you who have had coffee with me at Mishka's know that when I turned 40, I decided I don't have to like coffee. Coffee's bitter. It's gross. I'm going to put chocolate and whipped cream in it. And I still drink mochas even though I'm a grown-up. And I used to be embarrassed by that, and I'm not anymore, because that pleasurable event is part of how I motivate my morning routines. And building some sort of, you know, pleasurable experience at the center of a need-to routine is part of how you get these things going. It's part of how when you wake up groggy in the morning and think, oh, I'd like to hit the snooze alarm again, you can think, oh, there's that podcast I really wanted to listen to and I'm going to get to listen to on my run, or, you know, I'm going to get to drink that coffee. It's a smaller scale motivation of, oh, today's going to be a great day to create.
Yeah, and this is interesting because so much of the disciplines that we're talking about right now don't seem to be spiritual disciplines. But even this idea of coffee is not a need, and, you know, getting a hot chocolate or a mocha is not a need that you need to meet in your routine. But it actually can be a spiritual discipline of celebration. And for people who are going through our discipleship pods right now, that's one thing that we're talking about, is that part of the Christian life is knowing that we as followers of Christ always have something to celebrate, and that we've been given all these gifts of even just like food to celebrate and to commune and to taste and see that the Lord is good. And when we talk about disciplines, I think it often has this sort of alarm sound, at least in me, of like, oh no, this is going to be boring, or this is going to require something of me that is sort of imposing something on me instead of providing me with the freedom to enjoy life to the fullest. And it doesn't need to be rigid all the time. There's a lot of freedom and a lot of space for creating moments of celebration even in our lives, and that being a part of our spiritual disciplines.
Miriam, what you just said is something that I was just thinking about, and it's going to be the next thing I say. But before I do, I sort of want to recap what we're sort of saying. So we painted a picture of this disciplined life, and then we said, what's the first step toward that direction? And we said, actually, being intentional about the way that you wake up and the way that you go to bed is a almost cornerstone habit that's going to maybe affect the rest of the day. And I guess, should we get any more specific of what we mean by that? I guess maybe the first step would be to interrogate what they are right now, because we do have habits. Like I was saying, I had a habit of watching stuff late into the night, and it would make me dread the night because I sort of knew I was going to just do this again. And now I don't dread the night. You know, now my habit is to sort of slowly wind down my day with my wife and then chat in bed. And we often say this is one of the best parts about being married. And so I no longer dread the night. I very much look forward to that part of the day. Mm-hmm. So it just, a few things changed there. But I don't think I was totally aware that I had those habits. I think it's just, this is what tends to happen to me at nighttime. And so I wonder if the first step would be to interrogate those habits. Maybe a next step would be, what do you want to do in the morning, but you don't often find yourself doing? And then think about, when might I have to wake up to do those things? And what sort of incentive can I build in to make it more desirable?
I do think that there is a negative component of this as well. You know, if I get into work and I start doing emails at 8 o'clock, I will not write. I lose the possibility of creative sentence structure. It's a superpower that email is kryptonite for. And now that's a very like office cubicle, office space sort of example, but I suspect that there are similarities with respect to entertainment. That if you get into a social media or entertainment mode at 9 o'clock in the morning, or I guess an hour after you wake, whenever that is, still not calibrated to the college schedule, but like if those things come into your life early, they're going to steal the power of those first 2 hours. And so there is a sense in which putting a boundary on entertainment or even like coronavirus news and saying, you know what, that stuff happens after lunch. And we're really going to focus on the morning. One of the things that I've done with students in the past is, you know, just keep a little journal of your time in the morning for a couple of days, see where it goes. And then sit down with that little journal and say, how do I want my morning to go? What do I want this cascade of habits to be? And then start with a couple. And then once those are instantiated, add another one. And that's the way that I think you could get control of your mornings. I think if you get control of your mornings, your afternoons follow.
I think that's great. And I think that's a good place to leave that particular conversation. And because Miriam said something that made me panic a little bit. She said, we haven't talked a lot about spiritual disciplines or habits. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, do we have to start this whole thing over? Like, two of us are Christian professionals. One of us is a Christian amateur. But so
I'm a hobbyist.
We're pretty late into the podcast to start talking about spiritual habits and rhythms. I'm just going to leave that open.
Peter, that doesn't bother me at all. I think you know why that doesn't bother me, is I think that the secular spiritual distinction is totally bunk. I think that we are holistic beings that have mind, body, soul, and emotions. And those things are all interconnected. And so, you know, as you heard me lay out my day, I have spiritual practices. And I haven't told you all my spiritual practices. I've just told you the first one. You know, I sit down with the scriptures and I, you know, those of you who've taken the scriptural skills retreat, you basically know what I do because we taught it to you. And I journal and I interact and I pray and I generally pray the scriptures back to God. But the way that I approach that, I don't have this illusion that my spiritual practices are somehow different from my emotional or physical or intellectual practices. You know, we are ensouled critters. And we approach these different things in similar ways. And so I want to be someone who loves God with all my heart, mind, soul, and strength. And so all of my practices kind of have the same. And I do like the word practices more than disciplines, because discipline suggests that every day I'm going to reach down and find that willpower and make it happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas practices and habits suggest that, hey, the more you do these things, the easier they get. This is actually good news that these things get easier. And, you know, eventually, I really like the language Miriam used. Eventually, these things switch from a have to a get to. I wake up in the morning desiring these things.
Yeah, I do think there's a connection between the way that we learn how to start create these routines and these practices and implementing what we consider to be more spiritual disciplines or spiritual practices. And that's not something we want to neglect. I mean, talking about when you find time in your day to read your Bible, or when you find time to implement celebration or times of solitude, are really important. And I love the chance to talk about those things. I think when we were brainstorming what this podcast would look like, Stanford, I think you made the comment of, yeah, this isn't a particularly sexy topic. And I said, I kind of think it is. I really like talking about this stuff. So I could go on and on about, you know, what are creative ways to start reading your Bible and to give yourself over to the Word of God and allow it to shape the way that you think. Or when can you find time to pray? Or when can you find time for solitude in your life? Or when are you celebrating? When are you confessing? I think these are all really worthy things to be considering, but they are not separate from this idea of our regular, more quote-unquote mundane activities of daily life. All of these things, like you were saying, Stanford, are connected. Our bodies, our minds, our spirits, our emotions. And so I do feel a little bit of insecurity about, okay, why aren't we focusing more time talking about those spiritual disciplines? But I do also know and really believe that we have been. It's just they're more connected than I think we tend to think in the confines of Christian professionals talking about disciplines.
Yeah, I've tried two different approaches to my spiritual disciplines. I've tried the discipline of I'm going to let the Spirit lead me and I'm going to read my Bible on some topic that it will be determined at that time at some point during the day, and I'm going to do it every day and it's going to be great. And I've tried every day at 6:45, I am going to sit down with my scriptures and open it to where I left off the last day and step into a particular process of interacting with those scriptures. And one of those works and one of them doesn't. And just right. I'll let you guess which one it is. You know, understanding the physicality. And I actually, like, I have a nice journal Bible and I have, like, markers that I like to use, and all of the environment and the routine sets you up for the, you know, experience of stepping into those scriptures. And sometimes it takes a while, you know, sometimes, and this is true also with calculus, sometimes you gotta warm up. And sometimes, like, I don't get fully engaged in the devotional time until I've been, like, at it for 10 minutes, and then a switch flips and I'm there.
I remember the first time someone told me that every time I read my Bible, I don't need to get something out of it. I don't need to necessarily have some brilliant insight. And the incredible freedom I found in that of like, oh, phew, I'm not just doing something wrong. Like sometimes you're not quite there or you don't get some brilliant insight. But what's incredible is that still as you give yourself away to these things, it's writing a script for you. It's changing and shaping you even when you aren't aware of it, even when you can't feel it and you can't see it. But having the routine in place is setting you up for accomplishing long-term goals. Or not even goals necessarily, but putting you on a trajectory of someone who wants to be shaped by Scripture.
Yep.
And when it's more led by, okay, I'm just going to allow the Spirit to speak to me and tell me what I need to read today, and I'm going to read whenever I feel the prompting to, I just like am not sensitive enough, mm-hmm. I guess, to live that sort of life. And if I'm not sensitive enough to that, I don't know if the average person will be, because I tend to think of myself as maybe oversensitive sometimes. So implementing this routine and taking some of the pressure off of this has to look a certain way every time and just doing it provides a lot of freedom and a lot of comfort for me. And like, I'm not just doing it wrong.
I think that needs to be said pretty loudly, actually, what you just said, Miriam, because I think what my experience with students is there's a desire to read the Scriptures. And when they actually, you know, sort of exactly what you said, Stanford, sort of dig down deep and get disciplined to read the Scriptures, and then it doesn't seem to be doing anything, doesn't seem to be working, then it feels very discouraging. Well, I dug down deep and the reward felt pretty slim. And it just needs to be said that the reason we read the Scriptures is not to expect deep insight every time we read the Scriptures. When that happens, praise God. Those are such wonderful mornings. But the reason we read the Scriptures and the reason we worship is to become the kind of people who worship, and to become the kind of people who long for Scripture and whose way of seeing the world is begun to be shaped by the way that God sees the world and the way that the Scriptures paint mm-hmm. the world. And so it's a long-term project that has these moments of great short-term gains in spiritual insights to myself, but that's not the reason why you go every day. Mm-hmm. The reason why you go every day is for this long-term project where you become the kind of person who's going to long for the Scriptures.
Yeah, there is an author that I've read recently who described it. They said, you know, you are a lagging indicator of your habits, which basically says, you know, who you are is the accumulation of your habits, but the habits that have happened over the last few years. And so you can't evaluate the value of a habit based on how it feels at the end of a particular session of that habit. These are long-term projects. And, you know, the spiritual disciplines are a long-term project in developing your spiritual sensitivity, in developing your ear for God, in developing your character. And each time is a vote for who you want to be. And if you think about it in that sort of incremental sense, rather than each one is a God opening the heavens and declaring who you're going to marry or something like that, it starts to take its appropriate place in your life as a formational vote towards who you want to be.
You know, this makes me think about the importance also of what are the habits in our lives that we need to limit or restrict or get rid of altogether. And I hesitate to even bring this up because I have this fear of this coming across as sort of this religiously rigid spin on this conversation of disciplines that can already feel like a huge imposition on us. But I do think it's important that we spend some time examining our bad habits and things that are putting us on a trajectory that doesn't match with who we want to be or who we believe that we were made to be. And considering, Peter, sort of what you were saying earlier about the You Are What You Love book and the James Smith material about how what you're doing is actually changing who you are and shaping who you are and developing the way that you worship. And I want to be very clear here that we're not talking about how bad habits equate to sin, but instead how bad habits are shaping us in a way that we can't see immediately. Yeah. We don't see the immediate output or consequence of what watching or spending, you know, an hour on Instagram a day is doing to us. But if we were to be able to evaluate that long term, it is shaping us into a certain type of person. And what does it look like to evaluate those habits in a way that's not despairing and not full of all of this self-criticism, but is instead curious and taking responsibility for the fact that and the reality that everything that we're doing is shaping us in a certain way. And there are ways that we can limit those practices. There are ways that we can have some sort of control or agency over what is shaping us and what is developing our own scripts.
I think that's incredibly important. If you actually look at the New Testament passages on change and spiritual growth, like in Colossians, the text talks about developing practices, but it uses the language of putting on and putting off, like a garment. I like to call it the Mr. Rogers passage. You know, we just watched the Mr. Rogers movie where he, you know, takes off the jacket and puts it on. But right. Like the idea there is that, you know, developing practices is a paired enterprise where, you know, part of it's just time. You don't have time for everything. And so if you're going to put on new practices, you're going to have to find time for that. But part of it is that you have to replace the scripts. We have these automatic scripts for things that, again, aren't necessarily sin, but, you know, certainly are forming us in a way that isn't the kind of person we want to be. And so we're going to have to disrupt those scripts, but first we're going to have to become aware of them. And so if we want to put off those scripts, we can put on new scripts by forming new intentional habits. Again, maybe deciding that Instagram or YouTube don't even open until 3 o'clock. And, or maybe, you know, making the first hour of your day analog, working out of a textbook or something like that. Those are some of the things that I think you can do to start to disrupt those habits and just evaluate them. And, you know, I think that an hour of Netflix at 7 o'clock at night would make a excellent reward to work towards. But, you know, those are the sorts of practices you want to take control of and bound them.
Yeah, Stanford, as we were having this conversation of planning for this, you had mentioned, like, nobody should be spending time, like, on time-sucking activities before noon. And you said that, and I was like, oh, I do that all the time. Like, I spend so much time, like, doing things that are just sucking up my time and in little bits so that I can kid myself into thinking that I'm not actually wasting that much time. But then after you said that, I started really taking stock of how I was spending my time and realizing that there were a lot of ways that I was wasting time, and also that it was just like just changing the way that I was thinking and taking me out of my sort of focus work zone, and also filling me with a lot of fear as I was spending a lot of time reading the news, or yeah, just filling my mind with this sort of like, okay, we're in the state of catastrophe and chaos, and if that's what I'm filling my mind with right now, then I'm not going to be able to focus on work or focus on conversations or whatnot.
You know what's my fear in this, though, is like, so we're talking about a lot of the things that people like. You know, people like Netflix, people like Instagram, and maybe they wish they did it less, but these are the things that people, this is like entertainment. And so if our thesis here is you're going to do less of the stuff you like and more of the stuff that you wish you liked, it just seems like a tough sell. You know, it feels like we're telling people to live a more boring life. No?
I think that's exactly what we're doing. Is that entirely unhelpful? Maybe. You know, Peter, I was remembering, I think the last sermon you preached at FPC, maybe you talked about standing in line at the grocery store and just noticing your habit of checking your phone.
All the time.
That's super relatable. I mean, all the time. And what would it look like if we just didn't have that available to us? Or if we just made a decision that when we're standing in line at the grocery store, we're not going to check our phone and we're going to be bored and have to deal with the consequence of our own impatience or our own wandering mind. And even that small little practice feels very uncomfortable, and I feel uncomfortable recommending it to people because it's not exciting and it's sort of like, wait, this isn't the sort of life I want to live. But it helps us to be aware of how quickly we can turn to those things to provide us with some stimulation, how readily we can fill our minds with all this content or all of this entertainment just so that we can feel something, or just so that we don't have to feel something negative. But what happens when we do that is that we don't leave space for boredom in our mind. And boredom actually has a really important place in allowing us to problem solve and leaving space for that creativity that Stanford has been talking about.
Yeah, I actually have two responses to your question, Peter. One is very much like Miriam's. Yes, boredom's actually very important, and the ability to handle boredom's very important. I recently encountered an interview with an Olympic trainer, and the interviewer asked, you know, what's the difference between mediocre athletes and excellent athletes? And the trainer actually took a moment to think about it and then said, the ability to process boredom. Because excellence requires being able to push through a period of boredom and a plateauing performance to be able to deal with that is what it takes to get good at things. And, you know, that's, again, that's true about writing, public speaking, MATLAB. And so in some senses, being a person who can experience boredom, saying, you know what, I'm bored right now, but I'm going to push through it and get this done, rather than I'm going to try to medicate that boredom, is just part of being an adult. And I'm kind of unrepentant about that. But I would also say that practices are magical. They're magical. They rewire your affections. They change the things that you want. That's why we can't be naive about what it means to be a human, is because the practices don't just help us do the things we need to do. They change the things we need to do and the things we want to do. And so your language changes from I have to I get to. And it generates desire for these things. And so, like, I legitimately desire running, writing, the scriptures.
Right.
And I didn't start out desiring those things.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I realized, and actually it was exactly what we're talking about, is that I realized that I was just addicted to content, just addicted to having something in my ears at all times. And the justification usually is that, well, it's, you know, there's always the thought of like, okay, well, I might learn something. And especially if you've been to Lunch Bunch, you know this because I did this on Wednesdays. But on Wednesdays, I changed the habit of, I'm on my drive into Davis from Woodland, I was just not going to listen to anything. And it was just going to be a silent car ride. And I feel sort of embarrassed at how small that is. I was saying one time, one little 15-minute section, I was going to intentionally choose not to have content. I was going to take something away so that I would have some space for silence, reflection. Maybe this spark of creativity would happen, and maybe it wouldn't, but I was going to give myself that 15 minutes. And it was amazing to me how hard it was and how much I was appreciative to myself that I had done it every week. And it seems to speak a little bit to what you're saying, is like actually taking something away can be a great way to start thinking about our habits and choosing, again, like being intentional about, I don't want to be the kind of person that is always filling my mind with content. I want to be the kind of person who's reflective, but nothing about the way I was living my life was allowing that to happen. And I just want to say this before we wrap up. If you're anything like I was when I was first introduced to these ideas, you might have some questions in your head of, I thought in the Christian life, we weren't supposed to sort of save ourselves, that actually God is the one that's changing us and saving us. And if we're trying this hard to grow, then what we're doing is we're sort of stepping on the Spirit's corner, and it's actually the Spirit that's supposed to save us. And if we kind of dabble in this, we're not thinking about the right things. We should be thinking about our heart and how our heart is doing. And all we're doing is talking about how we are ordering our day. And we're saying that that's actually a way to be faithful. And isn't this sort of like works righteousness? Isn't this sort of like saving ourselves? You know, we're running up against time here, so we probably can't talk a ton about this. But if you were to just sort of take a highlighter and go to the scriptures and look at every time human action is demanded of us, you'd be pretty surprised. I mean, we are supposed to do things. We are supposed to work out our salvation. And, you know, I think one of the most helpful verses for me in that is in Philippians 4. And in this, Paul's saying, finally, brothers, whatever is true and honorable and just and pure and lovely, think about these things. But then he also says, what you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. That we are supposed to think about and dwell on and, yes, worship and kind of attend to our hearts and just sort of rehearse these things in our hearts, but also to practice the faith. And so there is room for us to practice. And in Colossians 3, just like Stanford mentioned, there's these verbs of we are to put to death certain things and we are to put on certain things. And that's sort of what we're talking about. Put to death the stuff that is taking joy from you and put on the things that are going to give you life. Put on the things that are going to lead you to the trajectory of being more faithful to Jesus. And along with that, being a more present roommate or a more present worker or more present student. So anyway, I feel like I needed to say that in order to feel like we close the loop on this conversation. And with that, I do want to close the loop on the conversation, and I want to bring us to America's favorite segment, Quarantine Corner, which is, again, where we have lots of time, as we've talked about, to do things that maybe we didn't do before, or just people are dealing with quarantine in a bunch of different ways. And so this is a place for us to give a little recommendation for how people can handle Quarantine Corner. So who wants to go first? Miriam, you want to go first? Quarantine Corner? What's your quarantine
corner? Sure, I'll go first. My Quarantine Corner is scrapbooking. Mm. I started a scrapbook. If you've met my mom, you know that she's a killer scrapbooker. She has literally won awards for her scrapbooking.
No way.
An award-winning scrapbooker.
she is an award-winning scrapbooker, and she spends most of her free time scrapbooking. And it's not a hobby that I've picked up much, but over winter break, I decided to use my free time scrapbooking and then didn't finish and went back to work and back to Davis and, you know, would sort of pick it up here and there, but brought all my stuff back down here because I figured now is the time to finally finish the scrapbook. So I've been having a fun time putting old pictures and old letters and all of that onto a page and just sort of documenting the years. And it gives me a space to be creative. It gives me a space to think about things in a more organized way. And I don't know, it's fun for me because I'm seeing pictures of my friends and just
are we in it?
Are you in it? Well, yeah. Sadly, it's a scrapbook from a time before Peter and Stanford.
Okay. So maybe if there's another thing that keeps us indoors in a decade, we'll make those.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Then good. I'm sure I'll be scrapbooking with pictures of you guys.
Thank you.
So that is my quarantine corner, finishing my scrapbook and following in my mother's footsteps.
Beautiful. Stanford, what about you?
I'm insecure about mine because it's insufficiently light. I know these are supposed to be fun, and I had one that was silly, but I couldn't help it. I have one that's on topic.
That's great.
I just finished reading a book with a student about the topic we talked about today. And it's not the most technical book. I read a lot of books on habit formation and schedule and routines. And there are others that are more technical, but it's I think one of the best popular books to really kind of get you thinking about how humans work with respect to routine and schedule. It's called Atomic Habits by James Clear. And I could imagine getting this book on audio and making it part of an afternoon walk or run that you do at the same time every day to have a habit about habits. That's super meta. That's my quarantine corner.
Very meta. I like it. Quarantine corner is anything you want it to be. It's an amorphous blob. You can change it and shape it to whatever you want. And because I am still in this position until Easter, which by the time people hear this, I'll be 2 days away from that. Because we can't watch TV or anything at night.
We should probably establish you're not watching TV because of Lent, which you said last time.
That's right. We are just doing all sorts of different kinds of things. And so my quarantine corner is, you know, when there's not maybe something like TV, and you're just wondering what to do. And so here's my quarantine corner. My quarantine corner is what Katie and I have succumbed to, which is just guessing games. Okay? That's what...
You guys can make anything fun.
The other day, we were sitting on the couch, and it was a period of silence, and I said, I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 10. What do you think it is? And then Katie responded with, I'm thinking of a letter in the alphabet. What do you think it is? And here's the thing. Okay, I guessed first try W. Now, based on my tone and excitement, what do you think the answer was?
H.
It was W. It was incredible. And then it became, guess what part of your face I'm looking at?
This is brilliant.
I was looking at Katie's cheek, and then she said that the cheek doesn't count because the cheek's just sort of general face.
An amorphous blob.
Okay, so I want to say, to combine those topics, I would watch television of you and Katie doing a guessing game.
Katie doesn't love it so much. What she thinks is fun is to find out what the answer is. I think it's fun to guess the answer. And so she will guess a few and then want to give up, and I won't let her. And then so she just goes, like, you're the worst at this because you just won't let me know the answer.
You do kind of sound like the worst.
So anyway, that's my quarantine corner. Just play guessing games. If you don't know what to do, just guessing games. It's a hoot. And that's it for your pod and your staff number 2. Thank you, Stanford and Miriam, for joining in this conversation. And before we go, I want to encourage all of you to check out the episode notes. There you'll find a link to a little document that coalesces some of what we talked about here that will hopefully help you start thinking through some of this in your own life. And we really do think that it will produce more peace, hope, and joy for you. And so, as always, thanks to Josh Paskey and Kyle Jung, who created the music for your pod and your staff. It is awesome. And thanks to all of you for listening and sharing this episode. It's been fun to feel connected through it all. And finally, to sign off, in light of Holy Week and in light of Easter, we'd like to say that we love you more than Jesus loves busting out of empty tombs. See you next week.